You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good afternoon. I think we should start. If everybody can take their seat, that would be great. Thank you all for showing up on this somewhat problematic day, I guess, for some, at least for me. It was a challenge getting out of my driveway this morning. Thank you for coming. And as you can see, the event today is a rollout, in essence, of Ashley's latest report, which is his assessment of how to deal with the emergence of China. What is the nature of that emergence for the United States and its interests? Long term, in particular, and how should the U.S. adapt its policies and the policies of its allies and other powers to deal with that? And to discuss this, of course, we have the author to my immediate left, Ashley Tallis, whom many of you, I'm sure, know very well. Ashley and I have known each other for many, many years, since we were going back to the Paleolithic era when we were together at the RAND Corporation back at, I don't even want to guess when that was, and worked together from time to time on various topics of one sort or another. So Ashley will, I assume, present some comments on this new report of his, and then we have three superb commentators to comment on it. To my immediate right is Nick Eberstadt, whom I'm sure many of you also know. He's the Henry Welt Chair in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute and is a political economist and a demographer by training, is very well known for his research, in particularly on demographic issues regarding Asia and China. He's also a senior advisor at the National Bureau of Asian Research, and he will be providing some comments based upon his particular expertise. Then to Ashley's immediate left is Eric Edelman, Ambassador Eric Edelman. He's a distinguished fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and he specializes there in diplomatic practice and foreign and grand strategy. He was a career minister in the Foreign Service, from which he retired in 2009. Very happy to have him here today. And then on my far left is Arvind Subramanian, who many of you also, I'm sure, know very well. He is across the street at the Peterson Institute of International Economics, where he's a senior fellow and also a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. His book, Eclipse: Living in the Shadow of China's Economic Dominance, was published in September of 2011 and presents an interesting argument about the future of China's economic capabilities. So we have a variety of individuals to comment on different aspects of Ashley's report, and I may add a word or two myself. So without any further delay, why don't I turn it over to you, Ashley, and if you could, we have 2 hours, four speakers, four and a half, I guess. So I'd say probably 20 minutes, and then maybe 10, 15 for each of the commentary, and then we can have some Q&A. Okay?
Well, thank you, Michael. And let me start by thanking, of course, all of you for coming here this afternoon. It's not been the easiest of days to navigate, so I want to express my appreciation for you making the effort. I also want to take a moment to just thank all the panelists here who have been incredibly helpful to me, not only in the writing of the report, but in my thinking of this issue over the years. Nick was my first friend, the first friend I ever made when I came to the United States in 1985, and has remained one since, which says more about him than it does about me. Eric Edelman was the Undersecretary of Defense in the second Bush term and was actually deeply involved in the issues that I'm going to speak on this afternoon. And by the way, is also the author of a remarkable monograph called America's Contested Primacy, looking at the whole issue of the claims about American decline, which was published about a year and a half ago, I think. And of course, as Michael pointed out, Arvind's book on eclipse really has defined the argument that China's overtaking of the United States is not simply possible, but that it's actually likely. So it's wonderful to have all three of them with their different expertise speaking and at this panel this afternoon. As Michael pointed out, the report that I've written really focuses on a large structural issue which I think is not going to go away. And that is the whole question of China's rise and the implications of that rise for geopolitical rivalry with the United States. Clearly, this is not an issue that occupies us every waking moment today. There are various kinds of crises that the United States is embroiled in, and China's neighbors are embroiled in with China as we speak. But my view is that hopefully those crises will be resolved one way or another, hopefully peacefully. And we will have to prepare ourselves, however these crises come out, for what I see as the larger question, which is a China that is likely to grow in capabilities, and that growth in capabilities posing certain challenges to the United States. In saying this, I'm not making the argument that China's continued rise is inevitable. I'm very aware that the Chinese economy, the Chinese polity, has a variety of weaknesses. But I do believe that China's rise is possible. And if the Chinese continue with the diligence and energy that they have put so far into dealing with many of the problems that they have confronted over the last 2.5 to 3 decades, then China's rise is actually likely. So I want to take seriously the possibility that China could rise as a great power in the comprehensive sense of the word. And if that rise does eventuate, if it does materialize, then I would argue that the stage will progressively be set for a new kind of bipolarity in the international system over time. I don't have any predictions in the report about what timeline this will occur in, because there are serious doubts about the robustness of China's rise. But I am of the view that if China is successful, then sometime within the first half of this century, we could be confronted with a situation where China becomes a major power, a power with comprehensive capabilities that is roughly a peer of the United States. May not be in every dimension and in every detail, because how one measures power in international politics is a somewhat problematic affair. But we at least can administer the sight test, that is, we know great powers when we see them. And I think it is possible that if China gets its ducks in a row, manages to overcome the challenges that confront it, we could reach a point where it could become such a great power that it becomes intuitively recognizable as such. Given that this is a possibility, and I would argue a non-trivial possibility, I think the United States has to think seriously about how one faces up to such a prospect. And I make the point in the report that the United States needs to do this because preserving American primacy in the international system is a desirable good. It is desirable, in my view, for the international system itself. It is desirable, in my view, for the success, for the continued success of the experiment that is now taking place in the Indo-Pacific with respect to growth. And even if you don't believe the last two propositions that I've advanced, I believe preserving American primacy is certainly important for the United States, that there are important American security interests and broader strategic interests that would be at risk if the United States were to lose that primacy. And the report spends some time trying to detail what those challenges would be. So given that that is a possibility that the United States must take seriously, I argue that we have to think seriously about how to manage this rise, how to confront this new reality. In doing so, I start off with the proposition, that China's rise is in fact unique when one thinks about the rise of other great powers historically. And it's unique in a very important sense that the internal transformations that have occurred in China in the last 30-odd years have benefited greatly by being embedded in a economically interdependent order that has been produced by American power in the post-war era. That the United States created an open trading system as part of its effort to deal with a previous competitor, the Soviet Union. And over a period of time, enlarged that open economic order to include China. And because of that enlargement, China's own internal reforms have been magnified, that that open economic order has provided a bounty to China, which has led to remarkable growth. This has not been the case with previous great powers historically. Most previous great powers have grown autarkically, entirely through their own resources, with minimal dependence on an external environment. China is different precisely because much of its growth derives from being connected to an edifice that has been created, sustained, protected, and preserved essentially by American resources and American capabilities in the international system. Now, the fact that China's growth has been importantly a function of its being embedded in this interdependent order sometimes leads to the conclusion that China's rise as a great power will not be problematic. It will not be problematic because the fact of interdependence will ensure that China's rise will essentially be peaceful. That could well be one outcome. And if that is the outcome that entails, then I think a major problem of international politics in the coming years will disappear. But it is equally possible that China's rise could be problematic for American interests and for global security, despite it being embedded in a world of interdependence. And that is because deepening interdependence has demonstrated clearly in the case of China that it can lead to the increased power of states. The catch is that it does not lead to the increased power of states uniformly. This power that states accrue as a result of interdependence occurs unevenly. Some powers grow faster than others. And the fact that China has grown faster than many other peers who are also connected into this in this interdependent system implies that China will have much greater national autonomy with respect to the choices that it makes in how it uses that power. And it is that increase in relative autonomy compared to the autonomy of other states that potentially could spark competition with other states, especially the United States, which is the established power in the international system. So the key in my reading of this whole story is really relative power, differences in relative power, rather than simply the fact of interdependence. I don't see the fact of interdependence by itself as assuring pacific outcomes in the international system. Rather, because interdependence creates asymmetries in national capability, those asymmetries have certain effects. And if China is growing faster than other states, then obviously its ability to pursue its own interests obviously is greater relative to the capacities of other states, and that's what creates rivalries in the system and potential disturbances in the global balances. Now, when I talk about relative power in this way, I'm really talking of comprehensive power. So I'm not presuming that the fact that China may one day suddenly exceed the United States in GNP would automatically make it such a global power. I'm open to the possibility that Chinese GNP might one day exceed that of the United States. It's not that fact that worries me, but the fact, but what comes after that fact, that a continued accumulation of gross national product could, over a period of time, enable China not only to deal with the vast development challenges it has at home, but could also provide the Chinese state with the surplus resources that are required to make claims with respect to security, with respect to status, with respect to standing in the larger political system. Now, given that this is the world that I believe the United States should anticipate, the question becomes, what should we do? And the core argument I make in the report is that we do not have the luxury today of dealing with this world through a strategy of containment, the strategy that served us very well in the previous rivalry with the Soviet Union. And the core argument there is that containment served us well in the previous iteration of great power rivalry because US-Soviet competition was a very peculiar one. It was a competition between two national autarchies for all practical purposes. Of course, the United States was interdependent, but it was interdependent mostly with its own allies. And the Soviet Union had some degree of interdependence with its own allies. But the United States and the Soviet Union were not interdependent in any area outside of security. It was only in the area of security that there was tight interdependence. But in terms of the economy, in terms of worldviews, in terms of culture, in terms of society-society relationships, the two countries essentially lived in different universes. Obviously, that's not true. That doesn't define the relationship between the United States and China today. And consequently, the kind of containment strategies that could have been employed in a previous era are strategies that essentially are not available to Washington. So I argue that what we need is a different kind of approach, and it's a strategy that must focus on balancing. And balancing essentially to me is creating a greater countervailing China power to the power that China can assemble, either individually or in partnership with its own allies. So balancing for us must be to assemble the greatest capacity, both our own national capacity as well as the capacity of our friends. And it is assembling this greater capacity, this greater countervailing power, that will enable us to maintain a global system that serves our interests, that perpetuates the interdependence that has served us well, and which limits China's capacity to misuse its power. So that's what assembling greater countervailing power enables the United States to do. And I argue that we have to do that in five ways. Now, you can read the report for the details. I'm just going to telegraph the five components. The first is the United States must sustain what it has already begun, which is a comprehensive engagement with China. We don't have the luxury of, in a sense, cutting ties, nor should we, because the relationship with China has served our wealth and welfare goals, both in the United States and for China itself. So you sustain those ties. Even as we do that, however, we need to pay special attention to the second prong, which is empowering the key states on China's periphery. Not simply engaging them, but actually empowering them, enabling them to become capable states. Because my argument is that the stronger China's neighbors become, the greater the likelihood that we will create objective constraints on China's ability to misuse its own power. So actually helping the peripheral Asian states to rise beyond what they would otherwise do outside of US assistance should become a conscious component of American grand strategy. The third component that I argue that the United States should focus on is tweaking the global multilateral trading system to serve its own interests. And the argument I make out here is that while we should continue to invest in the multilateral trading regime, the gains that are likely to accrue to the United States specifically from further expansions of the multilateral trading regime are going to be much smaller than the gains that accrue to the United States from specific preferential free trading orders that should be created among America's friends and allies. In other words, if the United States can create new subsets of trading partnerships that are embedded in this larger trading regime, those subsets offer us the opportunity to secure greater gains from trade than we might from simply a large-scale expansion of the global trading order, the WTO order. And the simple reason for making that point is because the diversity of countries that are involved in the WTO do not permit the kind of expansion that we would like to see in the abstract. We are simply not going to get those kinds of returns from the expansion of the global order in comparison to building these subsets. And the three subsets that I would argue the U.S. should pay particular attention to. First is the North American continent, which is really our base at home. The second is the trading relationship with the European Union, because we have both political, strategic, and very tight economic links with Europe. And third, of course, to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In fact, an expanded Trans-Pacific Partnership that involves many other countries beyond the current parties to the negotiation. The fourth element in this balancing strategy must be to ensure American superiority, continued American superiority, with respect to power projection in Asia. And there's a very simple reason for making this point. If the United States loses the capacity to come to the aid of its partners along the Asian periphery, in the Asian littorals, then the kind of balancing that is needed for the success of the kind of order that I'm arguing we should support, that we should advance, that kind of balancing will not occur. In other words, protecting our allies credibly requires us to make certain that no matter how China advances in terms of its own military and economic capabilities, the United States is always in a position when it can come to the assistance of its Asian partners should they ever be threatened by Chinese power. And so a whole series of investments in revitalizing American power projection capabilities are critical. And the final point I make is that we have to look to revitalizing the U.S. economy itself. None of what I have argued in the previous four components has any chance of success if the United States continues to weaken at home. And there is an extensive section of the report that focuses on this. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it. Just to highlight one or two points, we need to look at our capacity to sustain our labor force growth for purposes of maintaining our primacy, which means we need to think seriously about a rational immigration policy. We need to look at sustaining the U.S. lead with respect to technological innovation, which means we have to pay particular attention to our education system, to our capacity to maintain our research and development advantages, and particularly that we maintain the flexibility and the fluidity of our market system, which is, in fact, the best generator of innovation. There is a theme that pervades the report, which is the countries that can out-innovate the others are the countries that essentially will enjoy disproportionate national power. And so the United States needs to do what is necessary to protect its innovation. And, of course, the last element I talk about is repairing our public finances, because if we do not have our public finances in order, it becomes extremely hard to do any of the other things with respect to protecting our economy. The last point, I'm going to end on this note. The last point that I make in the conclusion of the report is that we need to understand the nature of international politics clearly. That is, if we somehow believe that we are moving into an international environment which is defined by a natural harmony of interests, then obviously we are not going to make the investments that are necessary to protect our primacy. But if we recognize and appreciate that the deep ordering principles of international politics have not changed, that the international system will continue to remain competitive. And therefore, the United States has to take certain actions to protect its capacities in what will continue to be a competitive international system. That is really the final point that I end the report on. So in a sense, getting our mental maps about what the world is going to look like really is in some ways a precondition for everything that I say in the report to make sense. So I'm going to end at that note and then yield the microphone back to you, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Good overview of the report. It brings to mind a certain term that you and I are very familiar with that was once coined by, I think, Zalmay Khalilzad, which is congagement as a strategy. Would you say that that is similar in your view?
I think in its broad outlines, probably. But if you remember, the idea of congagement was lacked content. I mean, it was meant to be a summary phrase or a an economic abstraction. But what I've tried to do in the report is that, and in some sense, it doesn't matter what you call the strategy, is to provide the content, the substantive content for it. But yes, it is a way of getting the benefits of what containment would provide without a strategy of containment. And I prefer to think of that as balancing rather than engagement. Unfortunately, the trademark on that has been taken.
Yes. Let's turn to Nick. Nick.
Thank you very much, Michael. Well, it's a pleasure for me to have a chance to talk a little bit about my old friend Ashley's work. I've been a fan of Ashley's work for more than half a lifetime since we first met each other, and this report is classic TELUS, I think. It's got a wide-ranging and commanding knowledge of a multiplicity of disciplines. It's very nuanced, and it is, I think, a really sound, sophisticated strategy. So you're not going to be hearing a whole lot of criticism of the general framework of this from me. What I thought I might do instead is offer a couple of comments about China's rise and also about America's economic outlook. To begin with, I would say that I expect that China, but not only China, also India, also the sub-Saharan African area, will eventually have GDPs that surpass that of the United States. And I'd say more than that, if this does not eventually come to pass, it'll be under circumstances that are probably pretty troubling for all of us. I assert this because of the simple totals of human numbers involved and the proposition that knowledge will eventually tend to percolate everywhere, as it is already doing, and that the basis for having more or less a convergence of productivity levels on a per capita basis will eventually happen. I don't have a time horizon on this. If this does not happen, a lot of the scenarios under which this does not happen will not be happy scenarios, let me say. Secondly, I also want to state the obvious and say that China's economic rise since 1978 has been the most remarkable period of economic growth that any country has ever experienced in all of quantified economic history. No country has ever grown as fast for as long as China has been doing up until, like, when we got together at 3 o'clock. And no country has ever done this, much less the most populous country in the world. So it's an extraordinary accomplishment, an extraordinary phenomenon. What I thought I would do, however, is to look at where China is now and where it is perhaps going. I know Arvind will no doubt also be doing this, but I'm going to use a little bit different sort of homework set from what Arvind might do, and then talk just for a moment or two about the U.S. So this thing is a regression scatter plot. I don't want you to look at it real hard and get the whirlies and stuff. I'm going to talk you through it. What this shows is a kind of a stylized picture of modern economic performance. Why do countries have different levels of per capita GDP from one another, like more or less right now today? And there are lots of different ways of telling the story, and the narrator is important, and the narratives are different and stuff. But I'm going to give you one narrative which I think works tolerably well. An awful lot of the difference in terms of per capita GDP levels around the world, an awful lot of that difference can be explained by just four factors: health levels as measured by life expectancy, educational levels as measured by mean years of schooling for the adult population, levels of social complexity or degrees of social complexity as measured perhaps imperfectly by urbanization ratios, by the proportion of total population that's urban, and by some sort of measure of institutional and policy performance. I use here the Heritage Foundation and Wall Street Journal's Index of Economic Freedom, but we could just as easily use the Fraser Institute's or the World Bank's Doing Business Index. They're awfully close to one another. What you see here is that with each additional year of life expectancy tracks with about a 5% increase in a country's level of GDP per capita. Each extra year of adult schooling tracks with about a 12% increase. Each additional point of urbanization, independent of those two factors, tracks with about a 2% increase. And then there's a big kick that comes, let's move on to here, a big kick that also comes from improved institutional levels. There's some interaction here, but we can leave that out. If you make a very simple, or some would say simplistic, outline like this, you can track about 7/8 of all of the differences in per capita output observed in observable countries in the world today. You see that red square there, China is actually doing a little bit better than you would predict by these factors. Well, the question is, how do you get to the next doubling of China's per capita GDP? Unless China is going to be a tremendous outlier from the rest of the world economic story, you need to expect big increases in schooling for the adult population, really big increases in urbanization, significant increases in life expectancy, and appreciable improvements in institutions and policies. It's certainly doable, but it's by no means trivial. And we have to remember that China is tethered to this world story as well as to its own remarkable history. One point. Let's see, this way we're going. Second point. One thing it occurs to me that we don't often talk about as a state capability or as a factor influencing state capabilities is national wealth. And the reason we don't do that is because it's so damn hard to measure. It doesn't mean it isn't important, it's just hard to measure. Recently, a group connected with Credit Suisse has been putting out a global wealth report. I think that its estimates are intriguing. I'm not sure we should take them as the biblical truth yet, but let's start with them as illustrative. What do we see if we look at estimates, international estimates of national household wealth? And this is aggregate national totals, not per capita. This is total national wealth. Well, let's look at the household wealth estimates from Credit Suisse to begin with. The blue line is China. The red line is Japan. The green bouncy thing is the United States of America. Over the period from the year 2000 to mid-year 2013, so estimated. One of the things that really strikes me here, since national wealth influences, you know, so many capabilities, including the capability, you know, in a bad word for world, for sustaining unfriendly relations or even conflict with a country, is the convergence like right about now, in estimated household wealth between the country of Japan and the country of China. There are many different ways of looking at this. It may be like a Rorschach test. When I look at this Rorschach test, I say, wow, China has been growing faster than any country in history for 35 years. It is 10 times as large in terms of population as Japan. Japan has been stagnating for 20 years, and only just now are the twain meeting. And also interesting, I think, here is looking at the cumulative national savings in relations to estimated increases in national wealth. So the U.S., as Ashley indicated, is a famously bad saver these days. It's only accumulated $2 trillion in net national savings by the World Bank's estimates over this 11-year period under consideration in World Bank numbers. But our household wealth is estimated to have increased by $20 trillion over this same period. Tells a little bit about the financial system and other sorts of things in the U.S. Economy. China has accumulated, it's estimated, $15 trillion in net national savings over the period of time under consideration, and its national wealth has increased by $15 trillion. So it's like, it's almost as if this were stuffed under a mattress or something. Very different system for translating savings into wealth, it would seem, at least at the moment. And this may have implications for the future. Now, very briefly about the United States. Since 1880, more or less, you know, as far as our national accounts, bold estimates of national accounts go back, U.S. per capita GDP has grown at a little bit over 2% a year. This is a very long-term trend, very, very long-term trend. It's not that fast, but if you do something kind of forever and it's exponential, you change the world. You octuple your per capita output every century if you can kind of keep that up. We've managed to until recently, but the future is always contingent. And there are a couple of things that I would point out that may have a bearing and even an adverse bearing on America's ability to continue its long-term economic growth rate. One of them has to do with labor force participation. Over the last 50 years, we have seen a flight from work by men that began way before the Great Recession. It began in the 1960s. I'm not sure this is entirely understood, but it is dramatic. If we had the same ratios of working men to men that we had in the 60s, we'd have 23 million more working men in the country. So it's not a small number. And aging can't account for all of that discrepancy. We're seeing a big changes in family structure in the United States. The U.S. has, at this point, I believe, the highest proportion of children being raised by single parents of any country in the OECD, including the famous Scandinavians, the broad-minded Scandinavians. We've topped them out on that. If there is a connection between family structure and human capital accumulation, we should be paying attention to that. Entitlements and public finance is a question that Ashley has raised, one which we haven't really been able to answer yet, I don't think. And finally, there's the whole matter of higher education and knowledge production. This has been a trump card for the United States since the end of World War II, at least, since the refugees from Europe and so forth reinforced our research ranks. But this is contingent, and the institutions for knowledge production are easy to destroy. I'm not saying they're being destroyed now, but they are fragile. And they are always contingent and require constant gardening, if you will, to be successful. So can the United States continue to maintain its long-term rate of growth, that long-term trend? Yes, it certainly is possible, but I don't think we should take it for granted, and I think we can be almost certain that we will not be able to do this unless we pay great attention to continuing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. Could I ask you then to
take, based on what you've just said, both about the various countries you've examined in terms of their development and the indicators that suggest what is required for further development and the obstacles as well as some of the positive elements that the U.S. economy is confronting, what are the implications of what you've just said for the kind of analysis that Ashley presented?
Well, I would think that if we were to add, Ashley and I go way back on some of these things. Knowledge production we've discussed quite a bit, and I think at the moment we'd have to say that knowledge production is, in the relative power calculus, leans on the U.S. side of this binary assessment, while China's certainly increased its university-trained pool, cadre of researchers, while it's increasing its knowledge production by very blunt instruments like patent production and articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals. It's not clear that China is yet punching above its weight the way that India is, or that it's going to punch above its weight. It may. That's certainly an advantage for the United States in this balance. I think that the accumulation to date, the stock to date of wealth, would argue towards the U.S. end of this ledger as well. Now, on the other hand, China has enormous, still has enormous untapped potential, both in terms of the possibility for economic and institutional reforms that haven't yet been embraced, which are, certainly should improve productivity. China has the structural transformation from countryside to city still underway, which should enormously improve productivity. One of the things that we haven't discussed here, and I don't think it's really discussed terribly much in Ashley's report except in some asides, is the advantage that the United States has, the economic and strategic value simply of having the English language as part of its wheelhouse, if you will. The world has become increasingly an English language world economy with respect to finance, to science, to commerce, and other things. And while we're very well aware, I think, of our seniorage with having reserve currency for the world, we haven't paid as much attention to the advantages that the U.S. gets from what you might call as kind of cultural seniorage in this regard.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Thank you, Michael. I need to start with two sort of disclaimers. The first is that while I appreciate Ashley's invitation to be here today, I have to acknowledge that unlike my fellow panelists, I dispose of no special expertise on China or on such recondite topics as international economics or demography. And looking out at the audience, it's actually a little humbling to think so many people have sort of braved the polar vortex in order to, including some people I know in the audience who have taught me what little I do know about China, that they're going to come and hear someone speak whose remarks are totally uncontaminated by actual knowledge. The second disclaimer is that it's very, very tough to provide a kind of hard-hitting commentary on a monograph with which you are in such fundamental agreement as I am with Ashley's. And I half suspect that those two disclaimers are the reason I was invited to appear on this panel, the lack of knowledge with which to challenge anything he said and the predisposition to agree with his conclusions. Having said that, let me just say that I think this monograph is extraordinarily timely and useful. I say that as a member of the National Defense Panel that Congress appointed to consider the Department of Defense's Quadrennial Defense Review, in which has been meeting and which has been trying to wrestle with some of the many issues that Ashley touches on. I've always admired his capacious mind and his breadth as a strategic analyst, and I think this Tour de Force paper puts those all on sharp display. It's accessible, it's comprehensive, and as Nick noted, it's extremely well supported by a wide reading in the literatures of several different disciplines: history, international relations theory, economics, demography, and security studies. I particularly agree with Ashley's conclusions that China's rise is the main long-term strategic challenge facing the United States, and that the strategic competition with the Soviet Union was very, very different in many ways, and therefore an uncertain guide to how we should manage this competition. I agree as well with his contention that the existing international system from which the United States, and I would argue the rest of the world, has benefited since 1945 will not sustain itself absent a conscious U.S. effort to preserve its primacy and to manage that post-World War II system, and that will require a very, very adroit combination of domestic, foreign, and defense policies, and in particular, it will require, as he argues, I think, very compellingly in the report, an enlightened and nuanced trade policy, a careful and attentive alliance management, the maintenance and further development of future U.S. military capabilities, and an economic renewal at home that can sustain all of the above. I even agree with his list of measures required at home to sustain that renewal, notably entitlement reform, as he mentioned in his remarks, immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform. In fact, I think we need to think about immigration, as I've argued elsewhere, as a strategic issue, not purely a domestic political issue, and our ability to lead the world in innovation. So having said all that in praise, let me make just a few comments about the security and strategy elements of the paper where I might have just a slight nuance of difference with Ashley, or maybe expand a little bit on some of what he's already laid down. There is a sense when one reads this paper that Ashley is hoping to sound a toxin that will prevent the United States from becoming the proverbial frog in the pot, boiling very slowly as China's power bit by bit matches and then eclipses that of the United States. The reticence that he rightly suggests has marked the past decade about seeing China as a strategic competitor, I think did prevent us from reaching some kind of consensus on how to manage that strategic competition or even acknowledge that we were in one. But I believe that is increasingly the hallmark of a bygone era. I mean, as recently as 5 years ago, senior U.S. officials were talking about pursuing a policy of strategic reassurance for China, and the Department of Defense's annual China Military Power Report and the 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review were being heavily edited to reflect that bias and to eliminate references or comparisons that might be seen as invidious between China and the United States. But I think China's progressive departure from the hide-and-bide strategy of the Deng Xiaoping era to the more assertive policies we've seen since the Great Recession of 2008-2009 have put paid to all of that. Today, I think there is a broad consensus, certainly a bipartisan consensus, that the U.S. needs to rebalance its defense posture toward Asia, and the main issues now are how, at what levels, and with what future suite of capabilities we need to address these issues. To some degree, I think this can be seen as a function of what Edward Luttwak recently has argued is China's strategic autism, which is its seeming inability to understand how its policies that appear to be, as Ashley argues, rooted in a hierarchical sense of what the order in the region should be, how those policies are creating anxiety among its neighbors and invoking what Luttwak calls the inexorable logic of strategy that forced China's neighbors to try and balance the People's Republic of China's rising power. That process, I think, has played out in ways that have led Asian countries, and not just U.S. treaty allies in Asia, to seek a continued and enhanced U.S. role in the region. Now, Ashley, I think, rightly cautions that it is dangerous, and particularly dangerous for policymakers, to think that this logic of strategy is some kind of self-regulating mechanism, and that it will, in fact, require, as he argues, constant U.S. attention to and management of our allies and partners. But there is no question that Chinese actions over the last several years have helped us a great deal in that regard. When it comes to maintaining the proper military capabilities to enable active and U.S.-engaged alliance management, I do think, however, that if anything, Ashley may be underestimating the imminence of, if not the long-term scale, of the problem. 3 years ago, when I sat on the congressionally appointed independent panel to review the 2010 QDR, we were told by then CNO Gary Roughead that the Navy, which was then projected to have a force of over 300 ships, could not at that point meet its presence requirements to assure allies in the Western Pacific. And since then, the budget has not kept pace with shipbuilding requirements, and the situation is considerably worse than it was 3 years ago when our panel reported out. Our panel then noted that we were concerned that, quote, the QDR force structure may not be sufficient to assure others that the U.S. can meet its treaty commitments in the face of China's increased military capabilities. This past November, several members of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission noted in their published report that, quote, the Chinese military buildup is changing the balance of power in the Asia-Pacific, challenging 65 years of uncontested U.S. military preeminence in the region. China is building a modern navy that will, according to our report, consist of 313 to 342 mostly modern vessels by the year 2020. If current trends in American naval shipbuilding continue, the Chinese navy will be larger than America's, and China can and will concentrate its presence almost entirely in the Western Pacific, whereas the U.S. Navy has and will continue to have global responsibilities. While supporting the rebalance policy, those members of the commission noted that if the military balance continues to shift in China's direction, there is a danger that the rebalance policy will provoke the Chinese leadership without adequately deterring them from aggressive action. And in this sense, I think one issue that Ashley might want to address is, how do you keep the kind of forward balancing policy he looks like from not appearing to be, in fact, a policy of containment? It's a distinction he tries to draw in the paper, I think with some success, but it's a tension that I think exists in the paper. There's also, I think, a tension in the question of how the U.S. can maintain its military preeminence in a time of budgetary stringency. He draws attention, I'm happy to say, to the work of some of my CSBA colleagues on the difficulty the U.S. Defense Department is going to have in balancing current readiness with appropriate investments in future capabilities, and I'm in broad agreement with that work. But I think we need to bear in mind that the current austerity is less an act of God or an economic necessity than is the artifact of our political stasis and the harshly partisan atmosphere in which this town works, something which Ashley rightly calls attention to in his conclusion. The budget top line, in other words, is really it's two numbers. On the one hand, it's a number that reflects what we buy with the appropriated dollars, and I think that's what Ashley focus is in the paper. What are we buying? And do we need to buy different kinds of capabilities for the future? More investment in long-range strike, more investment in intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, more investment in counter-electronic warfare, more investment in space, et cetera. But the budget top line also represents something else. It represents a symbol of national will, what the nation is prepared to spend of its treasure to defend itself and the international system that it built after 1945. And that number sends a signal as well to allies and partners in the region. Today, I think it's less U.S. current capabilities than future capability and currently our will that troubles our allies and partners in the Asia-Pacific region. And here, I think the Middle East is actually quite relevant to the so-called rebalance to Asia, because questions about U.S. willingness to exercise red lines in Syria, how we end up dealing with the withdrawal in Afghanistan, how we end up dealing with the emergence of a nuclear Iran, will all have repercussions that go well beyond the Middle East and affect the ability we have to assure our allies and ultimately deter China from engaging in activities that might threaten the peace of the region. I believe that part of making this transition and rebalance will require, and this is something Ashley touches on but doesn't address as much as he might have, an explicit division of labor with allies and partners that gives them some enhanced responsibility for being first responders for their own defense without, however, calling into question the U.S. role in providing extended deterrence. And some of what I think might be required in that kind of explicit and revised division of labor would be for our allies to procure and secure for themselves some of the kind of anti-access and area denial capabilities that China has been procuring for the last 20 years. In order to try and create some of the operational planning and difficulties for the People's Liberation Navy and Air Force that they have created for us in the last 20 years. Finally, let me just say that at the strategic level, Ashley suggests that a grand strategy for China, as hard as it will be to develop and execute, will allow the U.S. to deal with the other challenges it has to face in the world as well. And he cites two, new nuclear powers and regional aggressors. I might add a third, which is the continued threat of terrorism from Muslim extremists around the world. But Ashley suggests that a grand strategy that can manage China will be able to deal with all the others as lesser included cases. I don't necessarily disagree, but I have to admit that I'm just not as certain that that is the case. And it's for that reason that I believe not just better qualitative investments in defense capability are called for, but simply more spending on defense, since quantity has a quality all of its own. Ashley points out that alliance management of the kind he recommends will require constant and not episodic attention from senior policymakers. And my own experience in government suggests that time management is actually the most difficult of all things for policymakers to engage in. And I worry, I have to say, that much like the Spanish Habsburgs, who in the late 16th and 17th centuries lacked a mechanism for strategic planning that might have enabled them to make the adjustments that were required to maintain their somewhat overextended empire, which was global in scope, that our own decision-making habits and system will prove inadequate to the task that Ashley's charted for it. In order to meet that challenge, it's going to take a very focused and determined set of national security leaders here at home.
Thank you, Eric. Well, I'm not detecting much in the way of critique here. I'm detecting a good deal of agreement.
I'm waiting for you.
No. That's
why I'm turning to Arvind.
Okay. Thanks very much. Thanks to all of you for coming. It really is speaks so highly of Ashley's paper that, you know, despite the gods doing their best to come in the way of you coming for this event, you've turned up here. So, you know, it's really great. And I think it's highly deserved because, I mean, to add to all the compliments, you know, when you read this paper, what I really got out of it, I mean, what I really love about it, which is true for all of Ashley's writings, is that there's a certain absolute clarity in his thinking. You know, it's not just the comprehensiveness, but you know exactly where Ashley stands. And you know, and then of course, you know, you can agree or disagree with him. And I'm going to, you know, mostly. So there are bits that I do that are way above my pay grade, like security. So you know, I have nothing to say on that. And others have spoken. And there are large parts that I agree with, including the need for the U.S. to regenerate at home and so on. But there is, I mean, a key part of it, which I want to a little bit raise some questions about. You know, you used the metaphor of the frog in the well. I see this more as a kind of clarion call to some spine stiffening here in Washington. You know, I think the real target is kind of whooshy, mushy, wishy-washy liberals like me. You know, come on, don't get carried away with this interdependence and, you know, all this hunky-dory. You know, there's a real problem there. It's a kind of clarion call to spine stiffening. So let me begin by saying that, you know, it's not easy to clarify what Ashley's writings, but in some sense, I would say that, you know, one can define the problem in three not mutually exclusive ways. What is the problem? What is the China problem? And all three themes, I think, run through Ashley's excellent paper. One is China is not like us economically, and therefore we need to change China. And you know, people have alluded to the fact that maybe after the recession, you know, intellectual property violations, cyber theft, mercantilist policy, you know, or the whole range of things. So we need to make China more like us. The second problem is that China is not like us politically, you know, not open, authoritarianism, et cetera, so we need to change all of that. But I suspect secretly that, you know, what Ashley's really about is that it's China is not like us, period. And hence, you know, the U.S. must remain number one. I think that's where Ashley's really is, his heart is. And, you know, but I think some of these distinctions, I mean, they're not mutually exclusive, but they're also a matter of, I think, timing, you know. Maybe the economic and political thing is more a 20, 30-year horizon issue, but, you know, but even after that, Ashley might say, you know, I don't care. Even if they become like us economically and politically, you know, I want the U.S. to be number one. And that's and I think that's the clarity of this. Now, I'm just going to focus on this economic and trade dimension because that's what I know. So broadly, I think what Ashley is saying is, one, China should integrate with everyone else, you know, Latin America, Europe, and the people, countries encircling China. One, don't integrate with China. I'm not exactly clear where Ashley stands, but basically, don't integrate unless some really good stuff happens. So integrate with the rest. Don't integrate with China. Be tough on investment, technology, et cetera, vis-a-vis China. You know, so this is kind of the broad, you know, the Tellus strategy toward China. And I see this de facto as containment. So in a sense, where I'm going to disagree now with Ashley is that, you know, there's too much, I mean, Ashley's perhaps too much of a hawk, too much zero-sumness in this, whereas for me as an economist, I see the less zero-sumness, maybe a little bit more, you know, scope for a beneficial mutual cooperation. So I'm going to say three things, you know, in response to where I think maybe either I disagree with Ashley or maybe I would say it differently. On the integrate with the others, I don't actually disagree with that, Ashley. I think that's a very good point. But I would articulate it perhaps slightly differently. I would articulate it more in along the lines of, this is about a kind of a quasi-multilateral approach towards China, i.e. you don't deal with China one-on-one, you don't let others deal with China one-on-one, but you create, you know, a coalition of whatever the willing or whatever you want to call it, I mean, for two things, for two reasons. One, you know, there's much more heft at the multilateral, at the negotiating table vis-a-vis China, because it's clear that, you know, China has become so big that, you know, nobody, even the U.S. can't go it alone with China. You need much more bargaining, and, you know, and you want to do it in a way that, you know, brings this heft on the other side. But you also don't want it to be so adversarial that, you know, it creates problems vis-a-vis China. So I think emphasizing more the multilateral aspect of that, I think, is important. And second, I think something that you maybe underestimate is that I think the whole multilateral approach has the advantage is that it defines what's legitimate. I think China is much more sensitive to be seen as a deviant from international norms than I think we all recognize. I think China does care about soft power and being in breach of soft power. So even your the one prong of your, you know, integrate with the others, which you assert kind of in a slightly, I would articulate it maybe in a way that's a little less adversarial. So that's point number one. Point number two, I think, which is where my real problem with this is that it's all sticks and no carrots. And let me tell you why I would say that, you know, you need this positive dynamic, the carrot side of it, for two or three very simple reasons. One, I think, as Nick and others have mentioned, China's economic transformation is far from complete. You know, China's per capita GDP is about 20-25%. Even if it grows at about 6% over the next 20 years, it's going to be about 40-50% U.S. So the economic transformation is far from complete one. The Chinese leadership cares a hell of a lot about this economic transformation. I mean, you know, everyone knows that. Point number two. Point number three is that that transformation requires that the system be open, the multilateral economic system be open, because, as you said, no one has benefited more than China has from the system. Point number three. And four, I think, regardless of what you, how you assess what's happened in China over the last few years, I think there is almost a consensus in China that the way forward domestically is more reform, more openness. You know, whether you it's going to happen soon, tactics, all these things are, you know, open to discussion. But fundamentally, there's a consensus in China that that's the way forward. And to give you just one recent example, you know, they've created this Shanghai Free Trade Zone. As a way of opening up the capital account in the financial sector. I was told today that, you know, 12 other cities in China are going to emulate that. So if that is the case, if this is right, you know, there is a kind of, you know, win-win or you know, certainly not a zero-sum game that, you know, what China needs to do and what China wants is what outsiders want. So then the question is, you know, why not, you know, exploit this these possibilities? The other related point is that, you know, I think China does, I mean, creating a stake for China in a system is important, because even if China becomes, you know, powerful and whatever, I think it's, the fact of interdependence means that, you know, for example, suppose Chinese currency becomes a reserve currency. You know, it's not going to, it wants that reserve currency status. And once it acquires it, it's not going to muck about in a way that will actually derail that status. Because, you know, protecting property rights, for example, is an important prerequisite to have a reserve currency. So once it acquires it, why would it start mucking about and following policies? So there is an essential win-win thing, which I think you maybe don't pay sufficient attention to. Now, what form would these carrots take? I mean, just to give you throw out two, three examples, I would, for example, for the U.S., actively promote the rise of the renminbi as a reserve currency. You know, we can go into the ways you can do it, but it's in our interest because, you know, if it becomes a reserve currency, it will have a greater stake to behave and not do the kinds of things or do the kinds of things that will make it more like us economically. Similarly, I think, you know, I think China should get a bigger role in the IMF and the World Bank. After all, you know, if they provide the additional resources, why shouldn't they get a say commensurate with what the US and EU have at this stage? You know, I'm fond of pointing out that the European Union is a debtor in the IMF, and, you know, it still has veto power in an institution in which it has a debtor. You know, this is outrageous, you know. So point number one was articulate that more kind of non-adversarially. Point number two, there is scope for win-win, and therefore you need the carrot side, not just the stick side. And the third related point is that there is a cost of being too adversarial. One, a cost is that, you know, then China starts creating these alternative structures, you know, whether it's the BRICS Bank, whether it's the Chiang Mai Initiative, whether it's the RCEP on trade as a rival to TPP. China is now a power that is capable of creating these alternative structures and, you know, rallying countries around to that. Now, I am unambiguously of the view that the creation of these non-multilateral alternative structures is undesirable for the global trading system, in part because it allows China to play the very much the kind of pick-and-choose bilateralism that can advantage China and that we don't need to have going forward. I think a related point is that, I mean, there is a sense in which China feels that, you know, yes, it's benefited from the system, but it's a system in which, you know, the U.S. made the rules and has often rigged the rules in its favor. So, you know, so it has this distrust of the system, and therefore not to do the things that come legitimately with China's power, like, you know, promoting the rise of the renminbi, giving it more power in the IMF, would speak very badly for U.S. soft power. So I think that's something that I think one needs to keep in mind, i.e. the cost of not empowering and just kind of focusing on the balancing part of it. So if you put these three things together, I have argued much more for a a power for purpose bargain that, you know, you give China more power, but what you get is that you get Chinese contribution to creating a system that's more open and that makes China more open. So coming back to my distinction, if one of the objectives is you want to make China more like us economically, you know, why this pure adversarial zero-sum approach? I mean, there is a whole thing out there which needs to be exploited. So that's where I kind of, you know, basically my biggest point of disagreement with Ashley is. Now, two, you know, smaller points. On the, you know, point about, you know, the U.S. needing to be number one, and I think all the things that, from an economic point of view, I don't think China is going to remain number one. I think that's the, you know, if you look at any projections of
GDP. I don't think the U.S. is going to
be. Yeah, sorry, I don't think the U.S. is going to remain number one. So I have this, you know, index of power where I put together GDP, trade, and how vulnerable a country is externally. And if you believe my, you know, it's kind of comprehensive measure of power or a pseudo-comprehensive measure of power, I think China has already overtaken the U.S. And going forward, as long as China grows at about 5 to 6% and the U.S. grows at 2 to 3%, all these indicators of power, no matter, are going to diverge in China's favor. You know, that's just a reality. You know, you've got to accept. So it's going to be a really difficult thing to remain number one. And so all the things that Ashley wants the U.S. to do, which I think are eminently desirable, very sensible, I think it's going to be kind of not to remain number one, but to, you know, not become too much of a number two. You know, that's, I think, where the challenge is. But I think, if you really want to think strategically about this, I would highlight one of the things that Ashley, in fact, also mentioned that he has in the book as well. I think the U.S. attitude to immigration is, you know, if you could argue, is just too dominated by, you know, Mexico, skills, Tea Party, et cetera, et cetera. I think the immigration debate has not been informed by this big primacy thing, you know. And Ashley and I have discussed this, and maybe we'll write something together, Ashley, on this, that if you really wanted to, you know, the U.S. to be a robust, you know, remain robust economically, you know, if you have growth rates of 2.5% going forward, you add labor force of 2% a year, you get 4.5% U.S. rate of growth, and then you narrow the differential with China. So if you really think of a big card to play, it's what I would call the immigration with a vengeance bomb, demographic bomb to throw out there, you know, get all these productive people from overseas, maintain the dynamism that was so instrumental in keeping the U.S. On top. Maybe get these guys from China, you know, denude China, you know, aggravate the demographic time bomb in China and, you know, in favor of the United States and, you know, and maintain. So two small concluding remarks, or one small and one big. One small remark is that, you know, actually, I would like you to, you know, a little bit talk about, you know, in one sense, this whole trade strategy of yours is actually being overtaken by events. You know, the U.S. and China are negotiating on a bilateral investment treaty. There's a lot of talk motored by the private sector, including Hank Greenberg, that the China and the U.S. should have a free trade agreement soon. And China itself says it wants to join the TPP. So are we a kind of have come to this party too late? That's one question. The last question I want to ask, you know, especially with all you U.S. experts here, I mean, and something you don't touch upon, Ashley, is that I think there is a fundamental question here about whether U.S. political structures are appropriate for a world in which the U.S. is no longer the hegemon. You know, my view of this is under the separation of powers, you know, when the U.S. was number one, you know, a multilateral executive with an insular, protectionist, tough Congress helped the U.S., you know. Typically, the U.S. would go and tell its partners, you know, oh, please, let's, you know, negotiate, please negotiate, because if you don't, you know, Congress will be much worse on you. And that was a credible threat. You know, I mean, I've been in all kinds of trade negotiations, including intellectual property negotiations, where the U.S. has sat across from you know, Thailand, Brazil, and India and said, you know, unless you change your IP laws, you know, we want to help you, India, but please be reasonable, because if you're not, Congress will hit you with Section 301. That worked. But in this, where the U.S. is weakening, that is no longer a credible threat. To give you one example, very recent example, I mean, the U.S. did not vote for IMF, you know, the quota increase and the funding increase. I mean, this is absolutely stupid own goal policies on the part of the U.S. because it's really completely costless way of maintaining leadership, which the U.S. has foregone. And it's not, partly, of course, you could explain it away saying, oh, conjunctural factors, Tea Party, political polarization, et cetera, et cetera. But partly it's, you know, it's a structural matter. Congress is always going to be more insular than the executive. It's always going to be. And in a world where, you know, people say, well, tough, you know, if Congress doesn't want to, we'll go ahead and do Chiang Mai. We'll go ahead and do alternative structures. Yeah. So in that sense, I think a discussion of whether U.S. political structures are appropriate for this new world, I think merits more discussion.
Great. Thank you, Irving. Now we're getting down to it. Before we turn over to comments, questions from the audience, just a few comments of my own that I think probably are certainly more, not probably, certainly more in line with Arvind's comments than with others. I totally agree that I think Ashley's report is exceptional in its clarity, its consistency of argument, and its comprehensiveness in bringing in the multitude of factors that I think play on this issue. And I think it behooves you all, if you're interested in this issue at all, to read Ashley's report and read it carefully. It presents a certain point of view, which is important. There are variations of it, certainly, in various quarters, and elements of it have been repeated or have been stated prior to this report. But Ashley brings it together in ways that I think are very important. And he also puts an interesting twist on it. In, as he said, in his explanation of a type of U.S. strategy towards China that is not conventional containment, as you would interpret it as being. It is a strategy that does recognize that there are certain aspects of China's strength and growth that the United States would do well to encourage in some ways. And that's a qualified assessment that I think is important, particularly given some of the extremist arguments that are made about what the United States should or could do by way of counterbalancing Chinese power over time. My basic concern with Ashley's report, however, is really some of the elements of what Arvind has laid out, which is that I'm not sure that American primacy as defined is something that is ultimately either sustainable or optimal or most beneficial for the United States in order to continue to protect its interests. The kind of primacy that Ashley defines in this paper does sound a hell of a lot like containment, despite some of the qualifications that I've just said, and I think there's no question that it would be viewed as such by the Chinese. They wouldn't see the nuance in some of it. And to a certain extent, I think the analysis is in some ways kind of static. It's trying to account for China's growing power and the growing integration of the global economy and the integration of U.S.-China economic relations in particular. But many other elements of the global and the regional context seem to be in place and likely to continue to be in place. The nature of U.S. alliance relations, things that are a good in themselves that need to be preserved as an end in themselves, I see them as a means to an end for the United States. I don't see them as an end in themselves. So the United States needs to consider what those relationships mean long-term for itself and for its position in the region. Allies are seen as having their capabilities, indeed expanding their capabilities, but only insofar as they can serve to balance against China. And that places them, of course, ultimately in a subservient position if they don't choose to want to balance against China in those ways. And it also seems that in many ways, the maintenance or the compellence of a non-coercive Chinese approach to dealing with its territorial disputes seems more important in this report than exploring ways to actually accommodate China's aims politically without coercion or use of force. In other words, there tends to be an assumption that that's not possible, that you can't reach a certain understanding with China about some of the most important elements that drive U.S.-Chinese strategic competition in ways that would be meaningful for the United States or for the Chinese. And I think that is a questionable statement to make, despite what we've seen in recent months in terms of Chinese behavior regarding some of its territorial issues. I mean, the basic question in my mind, other than the feasibility issue, is how are the Chinese to be assured under this strategy, and this gets to what Arvind has been saying, that their most vital interests, which I would define as their ability to defend their territory, and especially their strategic eastern coast, by having capabilities that actually operate offshore, will be ensured under this kind of policy. Because if that kind of security isn't ensured sufficient enough by the United States or by other powers, the Chinese will continuously strive to maintain that or to achieve that. And if they don't, then we're going to look at an open-ended, increasingly intense arms competition in the Western Pacific, where the calculations about all variety of issues, large and small, become increasingly put in a zero-sum context. And I don't see that as ultimately benefiting either the Chinese or the United States. It could ultimately be, in fact, that even if China, if the United States is capable of retaining what you would call a level of primacy in the Western Pacific, that still wouldn't deter China from doing things that the United States could find extremely problematic. In other words, primacy is not necessarily going to deter in a way in which you might think it should, depending upon how it is constructed and how it would be sustained. And in fact, there could very well be alternatives to primacy, or at least the type of primacy that Ashley defines in this report, that could be much more optimal for the United States. Ultimately, in my view, our differences with China boil down to two fundamental things. If you put aside philosophical issues about ideology and political system and that sort of thing, as it relates to domestic political issues, it has to do with China's periphery and the territorial disputes that exist along that periphery, which are important, and they do have larger symbolic aspects to them, which Ashley does bring in, but I don't think they are necessarily a measure of what U.S.-Chinese strategic interaction is all about. And secondly, are the broader political norms and values that infuse the international system. And here, I'm much more inclined to agree with Arvind that there's more commonality between the United States and China in some of the most critical elements of the operation of that system today and going forward than there are differences. With the exception, and it's an important exception, about the implications of democratic society, intervention for support of human rights issues, and certain qualifications over the issue of sovereignty, the rights of sovereign states. Although I wouldn't push that too far, because push comes to shove, I think the U.S. position is quite similar in some respects to that of the United of the Chinese. So you're really not looking at a situation that is as diametrically opposed. The ultimately only argument that can really undergird Ashley's larger argument about primacy is the question of uncertainty. Because you can't know for sure how the Chinese are going to behave, you have to make sure that they can't threaten your worst-case situation. Therefore, you have to acquire a policy now to deal with that. And I don't accept that argument. I mean, I don't necessarily believe that that uncertainty factor is so critical that we know so little about it or cannot influence it to such a degree that we have to resort to the kinds of policies that I think Ashley is advocating here, which on balance I think could end up being less beneficial than he might think. I guess that's a critique then.
Thank you.
So let me just stop there. And first of all, let me give Ashley just a brief opportunity, because we're almost at the mark where we have half an hour left, and I'd love to have at least a half an hour for Q&A.
Absolutely.
Where he can reply to some of the comments that have been said. So, Ashley.
I suspect some of the issues that were raised by all the panelists will come up in the Q&A, so I'm not going to go down the list of issues, because they are extremely important, and they obviously need a more extended conversation. I want to make just two points, actually, one to Arvind and one to Michael. And to Arvind, that's a point of clarification. The reason Arvind stated my position as having two broad components, which is work to integrate with the rest and don't integrate with China. I certainly say the first. We have to redouble our efforts to integrate with the rest geopolitically, in terms of alliance behaviors, in terms of economics, and so on and so forth. But I don't ever say that we shouldn't integrate with China, because I take it almost as a presumption that we already are, and two, that that integration will continue to deepen over time.
But organically.
Organically.
Yeah.
So the assumption is that there is a set of bonds with China which, in a sense, don't require repair, because that is where the relationship in the last 30 years has already taken us to. And the report is really focusing on what I see as the missing component. And the missing component is developing the kinds of bonds that we have with China, with all of China's partners. Now, obviously, we don't have bonds with China that go to security and so on and so forth. But the missing component I see is the economic with the partners, and that's really what I'm trying to remedy. Linked to this is the larger point you're making, that there is a win-win space, which I understand and I don't reject. But I think that win-win space is subject to two important caveats. One is that it's actually much smaller when you look at the totality of the relationship, right? Because it's not simply deepening economic ties with China, but watching a China that is using these deepened economic ties to build up military capabilities that have the effect of threatening both our allies and ourselves. Now, this is the fundamental difference that we face vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. In the old days, the Soviets were building up their capabilities autarkically and challenging us. China is profiting from being embedded in a US-subsidized international system and is developing the resources to challenge the guardian of that system. And that, I think, is a very important difference that we cannot, in a sense, be neglectful of, right? The second point has to do with your power for purpose bargain. I accept the point in principle. I have difficulty accepting it in practice for exactly the reason that Michael flagged at the end, which is the power for purpose bargain works as long as I am powerful enough to enforce the bargain. Once China becomes powerful, that bargain can be revised if it chooses to, without any reason to check up with the United States on, you know, whether those terms are acceptable or not. So the problem with any strategy that involves a bargain is that it works only so long as it reflects a certain underlying balance of power. Once that balance of power changes, the ability to revise the bargain becomes inevitably part of that process. With Michael, I just want to make one point. I agree with much of what you've said. But to me, at the end of the day, it is the uncertainty argument that drives the case for primacy. And I'm very explicit about that in the paper, that as long as the United States has the power, it has a certain sense of what the international environment looks like and can make judgments about how to protect its interests in that environment. If it reaches the point where it cedes primacy, which means that it essentially cedes the kind of autonomy that it enjoys vis-a-vis everybody else, then it becomes subject much more to the preferences and the choices of others, then I think is good for the United States. Now, you may have a disagreement on the value proposition that underlies that, which is you can say that, you know, we ought to move towards a more equitable global system where all states have a greater say in how the system is ordered and so on and so forth. I just don't think that system is better than the alternative, which is that I have the greatest system. I have the greatest say in how the system evolves from the viewpoint of my interests, okay? So I agree, this is not a paper written from the viewpoint of an IR theorist who's kind of sitting out on Mars and saying, which structure is most conducive to stability? This is a paper that is written very much from the perspective of which strategy advances my country's interests. And because I think the strategy that advances my country's interests also happens to advance the interests of the global system more generally, and particularly the interests of allies in the Asia Pacific who rely on American primacy for their own security. That's the reason why I argue that net-net, primacy is a better strategy for us compared to the alternatives. So I'll just end there. And
fair enough. So, questions. Please, I ask you to be brief as possible. We don't have that much time, only about half an hour, a little less. If you could make a comment or a question, identify yourself, please, first, and then be brief. The lady way in the back, along the row, and then I'll go forward.
Hi, Ella Jo from the Brookings Institution. My question kind of resonates with what Michael just said, but I want to ask Ashley more specifically, if you play a little war game in your head, what do you think China's response would be to your first and third recommendation, knowing that China is already accusing the U.S. of emboldening regional actors like the Philippines, and then calling the U.S. Rebalancing the encirclement? And then, so how do you achieve empowering regional actors, ensuring U.S. supremacy and power projection in Asia? And by the way, the kind of power projection you're talking about is much more costly and difficult than what China is doing with their A2AD, the asymmetrical nature of power projection and defense. So how do you achieve your objectives without eliciting a more aggressive response from China and escalating it to an arms race and further destabilize the region? Thank you.
Why don't we ask a few questions and then turn back to you. Okay. Gentleman over on the left here in the back. Well, it was further back, but that's okay. Go ahead. You've got the microphone.
Thanks. David Sedney, I want to especially associate myself with Eric Edelman's comment that there may be an underestimation of the speed with which China is moving. One question, though, and I haven't read your article, but very impressed with what you said. But in terms of ideology, the so-called Beijing consensus, the fact that it's not just about economic pragmatism as it is, but there is certainly in China a belief that they actually have a better model to offer others. How much does that play into your analysis, and is that something that we should be concerned about, we should be having as part of a strategic approach looking ahead for China?
We'll take one more then. Okay. Yes, gentleman here in the front.
Thank you for holding the discussion. I just want to question.
Who are you, please? Identify yourself.
Chen Weihua, China Daily. By the way, I want to comment. I will go later to Peterson Economist, not just for economic question, but for strategic and political issues as well. And the question, I have a few. Just throw it out. I want to question the validity of this premises of that China is always the bad guy, the problem, and the U.S. is a good guy, the hero to save the world. But if you look at the world in the last 10 years, China has never done anything as disruptive as the U.S. has done in Iraq, Afghanistan, which, you're going to see the repercussion in the coming years, decades maybe. Okay, number two, the book is talking about not containment. But, you mentioned that maybe it's an unconventional containment, maybe it's a engagement, you know, and you also talked about, you know, uniting, sort of encouraging U.S. ally in the region sort of to stand up to China. But that sounds China, it's containment. So the other is you, I mean, the word heard here often is managing China's rights. But it's just put China in an unequal status. It's like, I'm your teacher, you know, you're listening. So I'm going to manage you. So how do, if you put your position in China's position, how do China feel? So it's not, it doesn't sound good. Thank you. I want to hear your thoughts.
Go ahead, Andrew.
The first question and the last question actually have a point of convergence, and that is the whole issue of, can you implement a strategy like this while being sufficiently reassuring to China? And it's also what Michael and Arvind came up. I think we have to make every effort to implement it in a way that will be reassuring. And in the report, I spend quite a bit of time trying to show why this is not containment in the old-fashioned sense of the term. But is this an attempt to constrain China's ability to use its power to the disadvantage of the United States? The answer is absolutely right. It is. So if you want to call that containment, then I have to plead guilty, right? Now, the question is, can one do it in a way that walks this tightrope between successful deterrence and perfect reassurance? I have never found a case in history where we have managed to do this right. Because I think the illusion that we can do it right is really an academic's illusion. It's an illusion that stems from the premise that all the problems that countries have with one another are really not problems of rivalry. They're problems of coordination. There may be a little, you know, issues of rivalry on the margins. And all we have to do is find that golden mean that allows us to protect our interests while maintaining cooperative relations. Between great powers, particularly at a moment when you have great powers that are in such dramatic transitions, I've never seen an example where countries have got it right. So there is a likelihood that we will never be able to square the circle, that we will never be able to deter successfully and reassure successfully simultaneously. The question then becomes, what are your choices? Do you say, I choose not to deter because the downsides of deterrence are so great? That's one possibility. Do you say, I'm going to invest entirely in reassurance and then take my chances that the world that comes out of reassurance will actually serve my interests? My view is that I cannot take that risk. So I'm willing to run the risk that deterrence may end up not being able to reassure China in a way that I think would be desirable, simply because the alternatives to not being able to deter China, and I'm using deterrence in the broad sense here, not talking necessarily of just military deterrence, but the broader sense of preventing China from misusing its power, I think that is so important to the United States that we have to make the requisite investments. Let me make a second point here. This is not a bilateral U.S.-China interaction alone. There are other players in Asia who have a very great stake in ensuring that their freedom vis-a-vis China is also protected. And the United States, because of the burdens of history, has taken upon itself obligations to protect the equities of these countries. We cannot reach the point where we basically say we are going to do what is necessary to reassure China to the point where we become unable to protect and underwrite the obligations that we have now undertaken for 60 years. So it is a difficult choice, and I don't mean to minimize or trivialize the problem.
You're assuming those obligations will and should continue.
I believe those obligations will and should continue because the alternatives to the lapsing of those obligations, I think, will be equally intolerable to the United States. A Japan, that decides to go its own way, untethered by an alliance, that chooses to develop nuclear weapons, that chooses to develop its own power projection capabilities, I think, will leave the Asia-Pacific region far more unsettled than the United States that continues the obligation of protecting Japan. And I say the same for India in a different way, even though India is a beneficiary of the externalities of U.S. deterrence of China, rather than a direct alliance partner of the United States. But essentially, that's my point. On the question of the Beijing consensus, I think the Beijing consensus represents, of course, a challenge in an ideational sense of the United States. But the success of that consensus is not going to hinge on ideational issues. It'll hinge on material questions. If China is successful, that will be the biggest prop for the robustness of the Beijing consensus than anything else. And so in that sense, what we need to do is not necessarily attack the consensus ideationally, though I'm not opposed to providing an alternative that focuses on free markets, you know, democratic politics, liberal systems of belief, and so on and so forth. But I think what is really important is that we show in our concrete achievements that the alternative is really the way to go. And so that's the reason why I put so much emphasis on the material factors in terms of building American strength, you know, building American growth, and so on and so forth.
I would just make one very brief comment, which is your explanation of this sort of duality or this tension between deterrence and reassurance and the inability to walk that line, of course, is, I mean, U.S. policy is essentially a version of exactly that currently. And in fact, many elements of U.S. policy currently are in your report. I mean, the real question becomes, what is inadequate in U.S. policy today and going forward that needs to change? And because I think to some degree, the kind of argument you're making is a conventional argument in the sense of the U.S. policy community, U.S. government policy. I don't think they would challenge a lot of, they might take quibble with the use of the word primacy. I mean, I've encountered that problem myself. But they wouldn't necessarily quibble with the basic strategy. But the problem is, you know, where's the difference? You sound like you would go much further than the U.S. would go in some areas because of what you call aggressive balancing.
I think and
that's the problem. I mean, if there is one, that raises the kind of problem that we're talking about. But I don't want to get into a. Let me just get a few more questions here so we can. Just gentlemen right here, and then Dick. Please identify yourself.
Yes, I am Dr. Nisar Chaudhary with Pakistan American League. And as far as Ashley is concerned, he's always very clear in his views. I commend him for him. Yes. But Michael and Arvind, they have really triggered the debate and expanded this issue for more learning even. I think national security is translation of economic strength. And if you go to Asia and tell China that we want to remain number one, and let's work together, you actually add to the insecurities of China. Instead of engaging, they will like to over-prepare themselves. And USA is the last remaining superpower on the globe. Even China cannot become a solo superpower. The world is going through transformation from a unipolar to a multipolar world. So I think my question is, in this context, that China has a very different system of governance than USA has. And most of the systems have their life, and they don't remain sustainable like democracy. Democracy enjoys really something, it's a self-leading, self-leading process. How would that affect, because USA, of course, cannot afford to operate on a thin ice, but how that system would affect? And what kind of probabilities do you anticipate about the fate and future of that system and how it will affect the strength and growth of China in the future?
And you're talking of democracy in China?
Yes. So.
Dick.
Thank you, Dick Solomon Rand. Let me suggest from another perspective a way to look at the situation. And I keep hearing, again, China this, China that. I think that's wrong. I think the Chinese are divided among themselves and are pursuing economic and security and political policies that are incoherent, that work against their own interests. From an economic point of view, they want to maintain engagement with us, but we see the PLA doing things, and it's started in the pressures we've seen, partly their military modernization, but then the pressures in the East and South China Sea that are working against the kind of engagement that the country needs to deal with its primary vulnerability. What is China's primary vulnerability? It's internal stability. And so the political elite is trying to maintain that stability with some incoherent elements. One is clearly maintaining economic growth. They mobilized these hundreds of millions of people. They got to keep them employed, therefore the pressure to try to keep the economy going. But there's also a very powerful element of nationalism that has emerged in these punch-ups over the Senkakus or the Diaoyu. And the elite is trying to deal with that pressure. Where you have a country that, I mean, this is something that Kissinger and others have stressed, its self-image is not that of one of sort of a balancing range of roughly equal nation states, but it's been the hegemon in East Asia for millennia. And that's the image that's in the heads of the population that the elite is trying to work with. So the Chinese have, I think, a very deep ambivalence about particularly dealing with us. On the in the public realm, there was an op-ed or a little piece that Cui Tiankai, the new ambassador, published called Panda Peace. You know, they're trying to pacify our anxieties about the rise of China in a variety of ways, but to keep us out. And if you look at their internal politics, they've published this document number 9 with the 7 no's. No democratization, no constitutional government, no competitive politics. So the Chinese are trying to, in an ambivalent way, maintain a relationship with us at a distance while limiting the impact that we have on their political stability, which is very substantial. Now, what does that lead to in a situation where, again, on the economics, they want to maintain a relationship, but in security terms, they're pushing out? I think it leads to a likely punch-up somewhere that is going to reinforce a polarization between the two countries and in East Asia. And until the Chinese political leadership, and this is Xi Jinping's challenge, is can he develop a more coherent policy that deals with their internal political challenge of maintaining stability?
Gentleman in the back there.
Stanley Kober. One thing that hasn't been mentioned, we've tried deterrence in Asia before. Something called the CETO Treaty, Vietnam War. In Vietnam, we deployed 500,000 troops at the top in theater. After 9/11, the greatest attack on our history, all we could deploy in theater was 200,000. In Vietnam, with the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, only 2 members of Congress voted against. In Syria, last year, the president decided he could not go ahead. Nobody was going to support it. Even John McCain was saying, no boots on the ground, no support. I see a trend line. Okay? Given this trend line, we've been talking about reassurance. Are we, in reassuring our allies, going to fulfill those commitments? Look at the sentiments of the American people. Sun Tzu in The Art of War said, know your enemy, but also know yourself. Is that an accurate reading of the American people given this trend line?
There's another hand up here someplace. This gentleman in the front, yes. Identify yourself. Yeah.
Michael Tint, Wikistrat. And my question is, over the course of adopting containment in the late 40s and early 50s, the United States, and particularly the national security apparatus, underwent a lot of institutional changes. And my question to you would be, what sort of institutional changes would you see as desirable or necessary to implement the strategy you have outlined in your paper?
Let me start with the last question. I think there are so many institutional changes that are needed, but one that comes to mind immediately is that we need to go back and reinstitute something like the policy planning board that we had during the Eisenhower administration. Because when I look at national security decision making in our country, I don't see any body tasked with devising and implementing grand strategy as its full-time business. Everyone does it when they run out of things in their inbox, which we all know never happens, which means grand strategy never happens. So at the highest level of abstraction, the challenge for us is when we identify what we want to do, is there some singular body in the U.S. government that has a statutory responsibility to do that and does that and nothing else, right? So that would be the first thing I would want to do. The second thing I would want to do is the way the national security staff is organized. In the Bush years, we actually had a Asia-wide national security staff, which may not have worked as well as it should, but it had one important benefit, which is one could think of China in a much larger context than just simply East Asia. And I think with the kinds of changes that have occurred now in the national security staff, some for very good reason, we've lost that ability to think of China in a somewhat holistic way. And so I think somewhere, it may not be in the NSS, it may be in some other part of government, we have to find a way of thinking about China as China thinks of himself, which is the point that Dick Solomon was just making, which is China thinks of itself as being a preeminent Asian power. And so a U.S. strategy towards China must be able to weave those elements of context into how we deal with it. I mean, I'll have to think a little more if one goes down into the weeds, and Eric may want to weigh in on this. So I'll just make a couple of points that were raised. On the democracy in China question, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if a democratization of China will suffice to attenuate the challenges that China's rise poses to the U.S. I'm really ambivalent about that. There is a part of me that says it will make things easier, but it will not fundamentally transform the problem. And there is a part of me that says no democratization will, in fact, transform the problem. On alternate days of the week, I hold a different position. So I don't have a satisfying answer to that. On the question of incoherent policy, the question about the American people and where we stand, it worries me. It worries me because if you take the viewpoint that the American people will not support a strategy of primacy globally and are not prepared to pay that price, then, of course, the strategy cannot be implemented. There's no question. But one, I'm not sure we actually have a durable understanding of what the American people actually want on this question. It waxes and wanes depending on the political moods of the day. As best I can tell, the American people want the benefits of primacy. And I think at some point one needs to take the time to explain to them what the impact of the loss of primacy would mean in their everyday choices. I mean, to go back to a point that Arvind was making, if we actually reach the stage where you have the renminbi as the global reserve currency. Will that, what does that mean for the ability of the United States to borrow effortlessly, to live beyond our means? Now, we may not think of these as virtues, but the fact of the matter is we can do many of these things precisely because the dollar is the world's international reserve currency. Now, if one begins to explain to the American people the reason for why the nation ought to bear certain costs, then that story must include, you know, it must be a soup to nuts story. It can't simply be a story about the costs that the defense budget imposes on the economy. It also has to be a story about the opportunity costs of not providing for an adequate defense, for not providing for a robust American capability that can protect the world system, which has provided all these benefits. And then I say, if we actually let the American people understand these, fine, let them make their own choices, and I'll go out and write a new report on, you know, what we might need to do if there is, in fact, a clear revealed preference for something other than primacy.
I can't resist. The problem with that argument is that, A, it's very difficult to define exactly how much primacy is enough and what the United States should or should not support. And secondly, the degree to which it relies on the United States, per se, in exercising the key dimensions of that sort of system that you're talking about. Now, if you listen to people like Eikenberry, his argument is this, and Arvin's comments kind of share this, it seems. I mean, the system we operate in today, globally, is a system in which there are many, many stakeholders, and the way in which it operates. And the question becomes, is this a system that should and can be sustained absent the American level of primacy that you're talking about? Or is it a system where the large number of Western European industrial democracies, the significant number of democracies in Asia that exist, industrial societies, along with the United States, are far, far greater in their influence within the global economic system than would be a China that is setting out to upend that system. And so, you know, the concern about the system itself, the argument goes, is misplaced. And so what you're really talking about is not the sustaining of the economic system, the global economic system, because that's likely going to continue, even if the United States is no longer a primary power within that system. The real question becomes the security question, the hard security question, which relates to the issue of, would China use its relative military capabilities, its increasing capabilities, to directly threaten certain equities of the United States, particularly in the Western Pacific? To me, that is absolutely the center of the problem. It's not a global problem. It is a regional problem. Now, you can make the argument that the regional problem has global implication, therefore it is a global problem. But I'm not willing to make that leap to that degree. I'm willing to say there is a system that you could put in place in the Western Pacific that would be sufficiently stable between the United States and China, where neither side has clear, unadulterated primacy. In fact, they both, in some sense, balance one another in certain respects, while at the same time the system itself operates under a system that is very clearly biased in favor of democratic industrial societies.
And that
to me is a very doable outcome, for the United States and for China.
I'm not sure it's a doable, it's a welcome outcome for those that are caught in the middle, right? I'm not sure that's the kind of world the Japanese want to live in, the Indians want to live in, and the Southeast Asians want to live in. But let me go to the larger point. I do not believe that the current international system will outlive American primacy. I have never seen any evidence in global history of any international regime outliving the hegemonic power that bore the costs. I think it is a fallacy to say that there are multiple stakeholders. There are multiple beneficiaries. Stakeholders are those who contribute to the maintenance of the system. As far as I can tell, there is one country that contributes disproportionately to the maintenance of the system. And we have not tested the ability of others to contribute. And in all cases when we've tested that idea, most others have preferred to free ride. They basically said, you're doing a damn good job of maintaining the system. Keep at it, right? And my point is, I agree
that the United States should not support that system of free riding. But the United States needs to get other countries to take more responsibility, including in the security area.
I don't think that's
possible. That threatens primacy, doesn't it?
I don't think that's possible.
Good luck.
See, we've had this discussion before. We had it once at a bar in the Randolph Hotel in Oxford many years ago, and I don't think it's changed one whit since then, actually.
We've been having this discussion for 20 years.
Anyway, thank you all very much. We've reached the end of our time. Please join me in thanking everybody.